Good morning. I'm sitting here close to the Bungie elevator in Quebec City interviewing Stéphane Turgeon, and it is September 1st, 2011. So, just so that we have you saying your name on the tape, Stéphane, would you just introduce yourself, where you were born, and then we'll start talking about your time in the grain industry.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Stéphane Turgeon. I was born in Saint-Hyacinthe, Quebec, in Quebec province, 30 kilometers outside of Montreal. And I live most of my life in Quebec City, though. And at the age of 19 years old, I decided to go out west and learn English. That's what I needed for school. And I wasn't good in school for my grades, so I decided to leave Quebec and learn it the hard way. And I end up in Thunder Bay in 1981, and I work in the grain industry since then.
How did you get, first of all, how did you decide to stop in Thunder Bay? Most people don't stop in Thunder Bay to learn English.
I ran out of money, so I stayed there, and I went to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. That's where I stopped, and I met a fellow there, then Dave Ferguson, if you could, and he told me that if you come to Thunder Bay, that his dad couldn't find me a job over there, so I did, and in 1981, I started working in a grain elevator called United Grain Growers.
Dave Ferguson, what was his connection with the grain industry, anything,
or just that his dad has a lot of connection for, so I kind of took his advice, and I came to Thunder Bay, and I got a job in
United Grain Growers.
That's right, United Grain Growers.
Did you have any connection with the grain industry in Quebec?
No.
So this was your first?
Yes, that was my first big job, and I kept it.
Okay. So where did you start with United Grain Growers?
What was
your first job?
My first job was labor. Like everybody else, they don't put you on it's too complicated when you start, that they don't put you in a car shed because of the cables, or they don't put you in a designated area. You know, you got to learn the flow of the grain first.
So what does a laborer do?
Well, he makes sure that the elevator is clean. He gets dispatched every morning by a foreman that he put him in a designated area to work for the day or for the morning or the amount of time that the foreman wants. And during the time that he works there, if he's if he has ambitions, then he could learn side jobs at the same time that he's doing his main job. Like you got to be wise. Mm-hmm. If you want to move up, you got to use your own time to kind of learn things. Mm-hmm. And then when jobs do occur, then you jump on them, you know, you take advantage of the situation that you say, hey, I know this job because I've learned it on the side here. And they kind of like that. If you did your own job and then you you learn other work in the plant, they love it. Mm-hmm. It shows that you have initiative.
Yeah. A couple of just general questions about that early experience. Then you came to Thunder Bay with English skills that you were hoping to develop. Did the fact that you spoke mostly French have any impact on your work?
No, not at the beginning, because like I said, they put me in labor, so you don't talk much when the broom is in your hands. So it took me actually 3 months, and then I was a bobcat operator. So I was unloading boxcar. At the time, there was boxcars, not rail cars, or very few of them. They were just starting in 81. And it took 20 minutes to empty it, 45 tons, with a bobcat, with a little tractor. So that was kind of fun, actually. We used to do about 12 to 16 a day, so per person.
So it would be just like a boy with a big toy, right?
That's about it. Yes, and for guys over there, they love that. That was the job. Most people love that job, or the cleaner job, because that was a dirty job. Because you go inside the boxcar and you receive dust and grain, you know, on you, so you get dirty, you know. So there was two type of work over there: the dirty job, the dirty work, and the clean work. So me, I was more like the dirty work.
Yeah. You felt by the end of the day you'd accomplished something.
Not just
and,
that.
And you could see that you had.
Not just that. I think for the dirty job, it was easier with my language barrier at the time. And over the years, I accumulated my knowledge in English, and then I moved up a little bit.
Good. Can you recall, now I just want you to sort of put yourself back in that first day or a few days on the job. What was your first reaction to the elevator itself?
Well, I thought it was very complicated. I think it's the way they built it, they're not all the same, but they all have the same purpose, is to elevate grain and then be able to ship it out. But the architecture of it is different on each elevator. The some has more room in the basement than others. Some are very, you could get claustrophobic, like it's close spaces, and but there's a lot of, you could see when you look at an elevator that it's complicated. The way they built it, it's complicated. Plus it required so much cement and steel, you know, and I could just imagine the hardship that people had to build it. Some people even died building elevators.
It sounds like you took a bit of interest in the sort of the history of the building of the elevators.
Well, it's a big building. I mean, there's many of them. And even if the eyesore now, it created a lot of employment over the years for a lot of people, a lot of families. But now that, the year 2000 have passed, automation has come. So now the elevators are dying one by one. Mm-hmm. So it costs a lot of money to destroy them. So they try to find other ways to use them. Mm-hmm. Instead of tearing them down, just use them for other purpose. But there's not many other purpose you could do with an elevator. Mm-hmm. So, but it's an amazing building, though. Like the way it's all built, it's very amazing from the basement up. And complicated to working there. It's not that easy. You got to understand the part to clean the grain, the part to elevate it, the part to ship it out. There's many roads the grain could take if you don't use the right slide or that sort of things.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, what surprised you most about what you learned about the...
Well, what surprised me about in terms of the building is the size. It's huge. It takes a lot of people to clean it up and to keep it clean. Mm-hmm. And for the grain business, it's complicated. I didn't think it was so complicated to from the seeding to the harvest to the shipping, for the countries to buy it, and the whole operation, it's complicated.
The whole system.
The whole system. From the seeding, like I said, to the end, where it goes in the country, there's a lot of politics involved.
What do you mean by politics?
Well, you have the Canadian Wheat Board, you know, and they got to go through the Canadian Wheat Board, I guess, to ship it out of Canada.
For the wheat. Mm-hmm.
For the wheat, yes. And then you got the barley that goes to countries like the United States for feeding, cattle feeding, or malting for the beer. But that's for barley. But there's a 21 grain actually in that the Canadian Commission take care of. But out of the 21 grain, we probably will see about 7 on a continuous basis. The rest, we have to have the knowledge to inspect it, and or manipulate it. But we don't see it as often.
Can you state what those 7 are?
Yeah, the wheat, the durum, which is to make pasta. You have the red winter to make cakes. You have corn. Right now I work in the eastern region of Canada, so eastern corn is in demand. Mm-hmm. You got soya beans, that's really in demand too. Then you have canola and flax. Mm-hmm. Those are the main grain that we usually see. But you have mustard as well that we will see occasionally. Oats that we will see occasionally as well. And that's about it for what I've seen in my life. There's already a little type, but I think my fellow worker, Patrick Chandler, could answer, because he's an inspector. He could answer more on question about the green issue.
Let's go back to your early career then with United Green Growers. 1981, so things were still going pretty well in Thunder Bay. Which, can you recall some of the people you were working with at that time?
Yes. The first person I met was the superintendent of the elevator at the time. His name is Raymond Cousineau. Very good gentleman. He knew I didn't speak much English, so he dispatched me in a spot where, like, grab a broom and just make some dust. But he was the first person I met, and a very, very, very good man. Other than him, Bill Belanger I met shortly after. And as some of my good friends there, well, you have Sergio Iazzolino. He's still one of my good friends over there. And other acquaintance that you meet over there. But those are the people that made big impact on me was the superintendent, Ray Cousineau, and my favorite foreman, Bill Belanger.
And which elevator did you work at?
I worked at McCabe's Elevator. Okay. It was M-House at the time in Thunder Bay. They closed it down now. Our company had two elevators. We had M-House and we had A-House. It's McCabe's Elevator. The name is dedicated to the family that I think that started it. I'm not too sure about that. It was the McCabe family, Murdoch McKay. Yeah, Murdoch McKay. Yeah, the father as well. And Murdoch was actually at the end was actually my boss at Winnipeg, which now he became the big chief of the
one of the commissioners.
Yes, that's right. He's the commissioner of the Canadian Grain Commission at the moment for the next 2 years. And I'm kind of glad to have him there. He's a pretty knowledgeable man. And yeah, that's about it for the people I met there. I mean, you're always going to meet other fellow workers.
Yeah. Did it make a difference whether you worked at M-House or A-House? Was one considered easier to operate? Or?
Yes. M-House was... older. It was built very old-fashioned. We still had steel cable in the car shed, and we were pulling five cars at a time. We could unload at three track at a time. The basement was very, very low. A man with 6 feet tall or higher had to walk with his back bent forward. So it was a good place for me, I guess, because I'm short. And I don't know, I just, McCabe, you get attached to the place you start. Mm-hmm. So McCabe is where I started, so I didn't like to go to A-House that much. But at the end, I finished my career at A-House. It was much newer. But McCabe had the view of the lake, they had a animals, wild animals at night that come around there, moose, deers, it's kind of neat to see those just right beside, right in your yard where you work. I was kind of grateful to see all kind of wildlife there.
What else besides, it's interesting to me that you say that about the wildlife, because I've always thought that one little sort of offshoot of the grain industry are the animals and birds that congregate around the elevator. So moose and deer, any others that you can recall seeing?
There were skunks, porcupine. At the end we had groundhogs from Saskatchewan that came in cars. And when we unload the cars, well, they kind of take off and they go in the backyard and then they make the family there. But we had ravens nesting on the fire escape of the elevator. We had all kinds of different animals, even rats at times, and mouse, but and mice. But those are the most common animals you'll see: deer, moose, skunk.
What about the birds besides the ravens and obviously the pigeons? Any other?
Seagulls.
Yes.
Lots of seagulls. Pigeons. But pigeons are probably one of the most nastiest thing you could have in an elevator, because they have. In their excrement, they have disease. They have scabies, and a few people did get that over the years. When I said my job was to clean the elevator, well, there is places that we don't use every year, like the dryer, for example. If the grain is dry at the harvest time, you don't need to use the dryer, so the dryer will get dirty, and because there's little holes where the heat comes out, the pigeon goes in there and they nest. So every 4 years or so, we have a bad harvest, which is the grain still wet, so we have to start up the dryer, so we have to clean it. And that's a lot of work. That is probably one of the ugliest, nastiest job you could have in there. People didn't like it. You have to dress in a white suit because dirty mask, everything. Yeah. So, but pigeons are probably the... If you ask anybody that work in an elevator, sure, they're cute, but they don't like them. They cause a lot of trouble, then, the pigeon.
So let's go back then. You started out as a laborer, obviously, because you're still here now. You moved on. So how did your career progress?
Well, my career progressed slowly because there was a downsizing in the mid-80s and early 90s. But I got the opportunity to stay on, thanks to Mr. Belanger, who phoned me my other job, and he told me to come back for 3 weeks in 1990, or around there. And I was going to be the last guy called. So I took his advice, and I went back to work. And from about 1988 to about 1994, I was just labor. There was too much downsizing. Nobody was moving up, you know. Everybody kept their job, and you know, everybody wanted to keep their job, and their posting they had at the elevator, well, that's basically the posting they had for those 6 years. We were just grateful at the end, and we made the cut, actually, and you know, so many people lost their employment. When I started in 1981, there was 2,250 employees. When I left in 2007, there was 330 around employees and on the waterfront of Thunder Bay. So the workforce has diminished dramatically over the years. And you could say it's automation the cause of it, or displacement of the grain being shipped in Canada. Instead of buyers or coming and buying in Thunder Bay, they're just going to go to either Vancouver or Quebec, which are at the extremities of Canada. They have cleaners now I'm pretty sure on both sides of Canada, so they don't have to, the grain doesn't have to be stopped in Thunder Bay to be clean. And again, the farmers do clean a lot of the grain now out in on their farm or out west, so when it's being shipped out, they bypass Thunder Bay in the winter time now, so there's no rail program no more in Thunder Bay, so the grain's being shipped right from west to from the prairies to the west coast or the east coast. So
you were talking about how your career progressed and the fact that there were a lot of cutbacks in the 80s, and you did a good job of summarizing some of the reasons for that. What was it like to be working then? It couldn't have been a very happy place because of...
During the downsizing?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't like any other workplace. Downsizing means everybody wants to cut everybody's throat to keep their job. I guess it's human nature to defend yourself for your employment. I mean, you don't want to lose your employment. So when there was overtime, everybody wanted it. Gather some extra cash. or show that you had a, you know, you were dedicated to your employment. And past mid-90s, from mid-80s to mid-90s, they got rid of a lot of employment at the company. There was 252 on the seniority list, and I think they went down to about 150. So they cut back about 100 job, I guess, at our place. And
brothers. Okay, I am now. We are now going back online. Okay.
All right. So, to get back to the '90s. Now you're probably going to say, why they kept me, the bottom guy? Why was I called to another job, at another job, to keep my job? To go? So for 3 weeks, I did two jobs at a time. I did 16-hour shift for about 3 weeks. I was glad after 3 weeks it was over. It's because my main job, my main quality at the elevator over there was to clean silos. Because we had a plant, we had a lot of oil seeds, like flax, canola. And at the time we cleaned those oil seeds, we had to clean them before shipment. Or else it wouldn't have been non-commercially clean, and it's not good. If the buyer wants clean stuff, well, we have to clean it. If you want clean grain, well, he's going to get clean grain. But cleaning oil seed brings a lot of residue. So. But those residue, they're not being wasted. Everything has a purpose in the grain. So everything is being sold, regardless if it's dust, regardless if it's grain or small seeds inside. Everything is being sold. There's hardly no waste in the grain industry, unless it's been burnt or fire burnt or really wet. So for me, my job was to clean silos, and I was good at it. And I think I was good, and plus, I guess if a foreman or your employer likes you, he'll do what he can to keep you on. So between those two things, well, mm-hmm. I stayed on.
So what's involved in cleaning silos?
Well, in cleaning silos, it's a four-man team. One man goes down on the little chair in the cable, on the cable. Down to 105 feet, or 95 to 105, to all depends on the size of the silo. There's different size of silo. There's round, stars, and triangle. Why there's different shapes of silos is very easy. If you put four on one, the middle one will be a star. And when you get to the edges of an elevator, you'll have the triangle ones. It's just because it's rectangular usually, so you get the round one, so you get three shapes of silos. But sometime when you have a lot of residue, there's a hole in the middle that creates, it's empty, okay, it's like a cylinder. You take a cylinder and it creates like a hole of 100 feet from the top to the bottom, but on the outside this hole, it's hung up. The grain is hung up.
So it's almost like a donut with a hole in the middle.
Exactly. Perfect.
Description.
That's it. You have the word. I was looking for a word for it. But yeah, that is exactly the shape of a donut. So you have a hole in the middle for me to go down in a little chair, which I go down about 8 feet at a time. And then I undermine it. So I cut on one side, and then I cut on the other side vertical. Then I make my horizontal cut, and then everything lets go. If I'm lucky, big chunks will fall off, and I won't have to undermine too much. But like sometimes it does happen, it's very hard, the stuff, and it's hung up 95 feet, it could take me a week to clean it. But usually a couple hours or half a day, and it's cleaned.
How did you learn to do that?
All that, you just, you have to be, I guess, a little bit of a daredevil at the beginning. Mm. It's not everybody that goes in there. If you're claustrophobic, they won't force you to do that. that's one of those jobs that even if you're the bottom guy or your labor, if you have a fear of heights or claustrophobic, they won't put you in there. I mean, they're not masochist, you know, like or sadistic. I mean, they'll ask for volunteers. But I had a couple of years in Quebec as a stuntman, and I've always been a daredevil. So I just, for me, and again, my language barrier. I felt that they were the job designated for me at the time because I didn't know much in English at the time that I got there.
So going back to the stuntman situation, so what skills as a stuntman were you able to put into play?
No fear. I just had no fear. No fear of heights, no fear of, I don't know, just no fear. Just put me in there. Give me a mask and a suit or just a mask and goggles or just whatever. And I'll just go in there and I felt at home there. I mean, I felt good cleaning bins. I mean, we call it cleaning bins, cleaning silos. I just felt good. I just liked it. You work hard, and I like to sweat. I mean, I was young, in pretty good shape. I don't know. I just felt at the end, and I accomplished something. Mm-hmm. You know, I gave them a new. Every time you clean a silo, that gives them space. An elevator wants space. An elevator wants the grain, and he wants to ship it continuously. If they could have it 12 months a year like this, they'll do it. I mean, that's the bread and butter.
Was there any danger involved in that, or was
it? There's always a danger, but everything we did at the elevator, I think it was, for what I recollect, I don't remember anybody getting really injured at the time I was there, like major injury, except falls. But for cleaning silos, no. I don't. You could bang your knee because a chunk of grain kind of hit the chair and threw you against the wall of the silo, or you could get cut on the side of your head because your head hit the bar of the chair. But those are little things. I mean, back in the old days, building the elevator, I'm sure they had worse accident than that.
So when you talked about falls, what kind of falls were? Ordinary in elevators, is it more like tripping over something, or is it actually?
If you climb a ladder to go clean the top of a machine, and you slip, dust on metal gets very slippery with your boots. With rubber, the rubber on the dust on metal, it's dangerous. And then sometimes it rains, and the rain comes in, and that too gets slippery. Mm-hmm. Usually it's for a lack of attention because, I never fell. So I did lose a piece of my thumb, though.
How did that happen?
In a car shed at AOS. I started at McCabe, but I finished AOS in 1984. That was 3 years after I started. It was on a midnight shift at 4 in the morning. And the cable fell off. And the man that was winching, he was 62 years old. Good man, I won't mention his name. And the cable fell off, and I gave him my signal with my hand to stop the cable. He did. As I put it back on the boxcar, I guess he thought I'd give him the signal to start ahead. So he started winching with the cable, but my hand was still there. So my hand got caught between the boxcar and the cable. Mm-hmm. And I spotted the whole car yelling at him, but because the horn was on, and he was 62, and he had high sight problem plus a near sight, an earring problem. He didn't hear me nor see me, so I just spotted the whole boxcar. And when he was done, piece of my thumb, the part of my glove, the thumb part of my glove, fell with my piece of thumb in the basement. So one of my fellow workers went and got it from the basement, and I went straight to the hospital. I was off only 2.5 weeks. I came back after.
So when you say you spotted the car throughout this, what does that mean?
Well, all rail cars that we received, they go in the back of the car shed. And as we move along during our day of work, doing our daily work, we have to unload those rail cars. But we cannot winch. They were a boxcar. So in order to unload the boxcar at AL's, It wasn't like McCabe. It wasn't with Bobcat. It was with a dumper, a real dumper. So you had to spot the boxcar on the dumper individually, not like McCabe where you get five cars at the time and then cut them off and spot it on top of the...
So spot means really to just locate it on the...
That is correct.
Over the chute.
That, well, over the place the, where it'll balance left and right. And
in the case of...
Down and up. Okay. And with the crossbar that goes in the middle, you know, mm-hmm. the arm that they call to go inside to let go the green into the hopper.
Spotting is a term I've heard often, but I never really understood what it meant, so thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, spotting a car is, it means that out of the cars that you receive for the day, you just bring one at a time or five at a time or whatever the each elevator, like I said, they all built different. So they all, plus they all have their way to work differently. So each company or each elevator, they, you know, back then, there was both boxcar and rail cars. So McCabe was designated to do both, so is AOS. But one was with Bobcat and the other one was with a dumper. But those are all the jobs that you, I guess, that I knew, that I did all these jobs, but not at full time. Like.
So I have a couple of questions from what you've said. One was, I have heard in doing these tapes that there was a person once caught inside a bin over a weekend. Was that part of the...
Yes,
the stories that you've heard, it is true?
No, it is a true story. The man is deceased right now. I don't know if you want to hear the name, or I don't know if it matters.
I suspect there was a report written up.
Oh, I don't know. Back then, I don't know if there was anything written up.
Why don't we just not put the name, and
okay.
You can tell me later, and then you know, we can work out some way. But it is a true story.
It is a true story. It is actually a real true story. There was only one shift, the time in that your incident that you want to know about.
What elevator did it occur at?
It happened at McCabe.
Oh, really?
If I'm not mistaken, it was at McCabe. It was the elevator where I started. The man went down to clean a silo, like the job that I'm doing, that I like to do. And at 4 o'clock, the three people that remained on top thought there was another shift coming on. So they left. But right there, they don't do that no more. You don't leave the man down in the silo unattended. What they did was wrong. I have to admit, I'm the one who goes down the silo usually. I wouldn't like my crew to leave me. And there was no radio at the time. Walkie-talkies, they weren't really perfected to go down. And even in our days, a radio with a lot of dust doesn't work properly. So a lot of time you have bad connection. You have to remember, in the cement to build an elevator, there's rebar. There's a lot of metal. There's a lot of steel to hold the cement. So if you have one silo and another silo, another silo, and the tower to communicate with your radio is located in another building outside the elevator, the communication might not come around. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, to get back to the story of the man, he was left on a Friday at 4 o'clock, the man on top, they left. They went home. So the man inside the silo, well, he just continued working until when he realized he was tired, so he started yelling, "Hey, get me out." But there was nobody on top. So he just sat in his chair until Sunday when they got him out. They found him, he was singing. And he was tired.
Was there any ill effects from that?
Well, 2 days on a chair, doing nothing. You in the middle, about 50 feet. The height is about 50 feet. You can't go down, you can't go up. Mm-hmm. There's not much to do. Plus, you still need your daily routine of living, you know? If you get my drift, washroom, you know? So the man was left 2 days there, so they found him, you know. There's no way to undo nothing there. There's no way to go to washroom, so you have to do in your pants.
Was he off work afterwards?
I'm not sure. There's rumors that he took a week off. There's rumors that he got more money. There's rumors, but that is not the issue. I think the issue was to leave someone for a weekend like that. It was not properly It was not properly done.
But accident. It was an accident.
It was an accident, but it could have been prevented, I guess, because common sense. You don't leave someone in a silo and all three people on top goes home. I mean, you got to wait for the other crew to come in.
So do you know approximately when this happened?
Well, that was long ago.
Before your time?
Late 60s or early 70s. That was way, way, way before my time. Mm. Back then, there was not much rules. There was a lot of drinking, too, back then, in those times, on the side of the elevator.
Did you see changes in sort of safety and alcohol use?
But 2 years after I started there, and there was no more alcohol.
What do you think made that change?
Society changed. Injuries. Modernization, you know, things got to look at the way it is in 2010 compared to 1980. So, like, I haven't seen before 1980, so I can't really make a judgment on that. But for what I have seen of the elevator from 81 to 2007, every 10 years you could see a big drastic change, either in the way the philosophy with their employees, or with the downsizing, or with the dislocation of the grain, like the displacement of the grain, like from, I guess it's downsizing indirectly, but everything, automation. So all this put together, yeah, safety and common sense, I guess, came in place eventually. Mm-hmm. I mean, walking around with a bottle of whiskey between cleaning grain back in the 60s, it was common. I mean, people walking in the shed with a beer was common. Construction workers, even around the Canada, making roads, it was common too. Like it was, but over the years, they say that alcohol, well, it brings us. Brings effect, so it's not. It shouldn't be tolerated at work, which is right too.
Did I shouldn't say this. I'm putting words in your mouth. Were there issues then between those who drank on the job and those who didn't?
No. Well, I mean issues. It all depends what you mean by drinking on the job. I mean, there's drinking and it's getting drunk. Both occurred, actually. When there's booze, somebody's gonna get drunk. I guess after the first year I started there, there was a few things that did occur that the foreman had no choice but to put a stop at certain things. I'd rather not go into many details. I think it just tarnished the image of the industry, I guess.
It's the reality of the industry, and you are not the first person to mention the drinking.
I'm not the first person. I'm not going to be the last one. I mean, but it's not like that no more, though. There's a zero tolerance, almost like driving. Zero tolerance for drinking and driving. I mean, drinking and working.
So without naming names, but it would be interesting to have... got so bad that it no longer was tolerable?
Well, I guess people sleeping drunk. Falling asleep, they're drunk, and there's a mix, or there's a spill, or there's injuries. Plus, just the way life goes, you know? Like, you don't work. I mean, it's basically accident, I would have to say.
What this makes me think of, and I don't know why I make the connection, but it would have been about that time, too, that women started working on the job. Or was that a little later?
Working on a job, you mean as an employee of an elevator?
Mm-hmm. Other than in the office.
Yeah, but I mean, as an employee in the elevator or as an employee of the Canadian Grain Commission?
Canadian Grain Commission, but they would be present at the elevator.
When I started in 1981, there was no female employee on my side of the industry, meaning that United Grain Growers didn't employ women to work inside the plant. And to the day that I left the elevator, there was no women.
You left the elevator when?
In 2007. So from 1981 to 2007, there was no women. Not one woman got hired at United Grain Growers, Agricore United, or Viterra. Those are the three companies that I did work over the years. But their philosophy with women in the plant is they cannot do the same than a man on a regular basis. So if they would be the bottom person on the seniority list, everything worked with the seniority over there. So if the person who's the bottom person and cannot do the same than the man, well then the person ahead of that person will have to work for her. So they decided, instead of having conflict of interest, that they wouldn't hire any women. But Sasquipool did hire, or Cargill did hire a woman, and she's still there, I think, up to this day. So she, there is exception that in any workforce that either sex could do the job. But instead of taking the gamble on it, or their policy of the company I work for, they decided not to hire any. So I thought that was okay. As for the Canadian Grain Commission, I started in 1981, and yes, there was female at the time on the work site. Some were alert, and some weren't. They didn't really understand the grain. But over the years, some of the female they hired became some of the best inspectors. I always said, the female are better, they have a better eyesight, or they're more attentive to what they do, I guess, and minutieuse, they do refine work, like they take their work a very...
attention to detail?
Well, yes, and they're softer, like, I don't know how to explain that. Looking at grain in media, you don't need to be a man to do that. I think that was a good job for a woman. Because the Canadian Grain Commission has two parts of it. You have the inspection side and the weigher. The weigher is more like a man job because you deal with the guys at work. You're in the control room where the environment is guys. So guys say things sometimes that they regret, right, in front of women. And it's vice versa, but in this case, it was men. So when a woman was a weigher and she comes into a room where you have six employees in the control room, all men, and then she walks in, well, she has to, especially at the beginning, it must have been pretty tough for those women to hear guys talk, shock talk, which is sometimes pretty nasty. So some didn't care. They just said, they guys, let them talk. But some took it personal. So, but to get back, the waiter, I thought he was more like a guy thing, because you with the guys. But the inspection side, you dealt with the more refined people. People that were dressing civil clothes to work and looking at grain and dealing with the foremen and dealing with the more like the...
They showered on a regular basis.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. They don't drink too much at the elevator, that back in the old days. Like they were more like, dress well. And I thought the women fit really well in that.
A culture. Yeah. We talk about a culture of a workplace, so that I understand exactly what you're saying. So, because of our timing, I don't want to lose sight of your career. So let's move on. We can spend a lot more time, obviously. But we left you when you were talking about your time cleaning bins. Was that what you did until you left, or?
Well, you don't do that. You don't clean silos every day.
Okay. So how did you move along? What else?
Okay, I'll give a description of some of the work that I've done over the years.
Yeah.
I worked as a laborer. I started there. In the meantime, while I was working as a laborer, I've learned on the side how to use a bobcat, either in my breaks or either when foremen's are not looking at me sweeping, or I do an hour sweeping and then they tell me, take advantage of the situation. If you're sweeping in a car shed, ask around how to operate machines. Like learn on your own. Like show initiative, like a personal initiative. So I've learned how to use a Bobcat. Then I've learned to work on a distributing floor. That's where you put your spouts on, either on the proper silo number, so the grain going in the right place in the elevator, or on a shipping bin, which it goes straight to the boat, or the cleaners to get clean. So the purpose of that job, distributing floor, is to dispatch your silos at the right place. And I've learned working in the annex with the trips, which is a machine that moves on the belt, a moving belt, to place on the right hole in the annex to put the grain in the right place.
So it's sort of like almost like a transportation system. So you're going along and the grain has to go off into different directions and the trips.
No, it doesn't go in different directions. It always goes straight.
Okay.
But let's say you have bin 600, then bin 601, then 602. But this time it's two red, two CWRS, Canadian Western Red Spring. You want to put that into a silo 602, but the trip is set on 600. The trip is the machine that will move to the right place.
Okay.
It's a converter belt. Okay. So the trip is inside the converter belt. Inside the trip,
the conveyor belt.
So in order to move all the grain moves on the conveyor belt, so in order to go to the right place, you need the trip to set it there. So we call it a trip or a tripper, or it all depends which place you work. So the guy that works on that floor, he takes it from my example, 600, and he moves it to two bins ahead to 602. Once it's set there, he'll set this fan to get the dust into the air system. He'll put the brake onto the machine, and he'll set it fixed. And then he'll call on the radio that 602 is ready to go, ready to receive grain. So, and then the control operator will let go the grain, and once he see the grain going safely into the silo, then he could walk away from that place and do another set somewhere else. Usually there's three trips per annex. So there'll be three on the outshore annex, and there'll be three on the inshore annex if they have two sites, like we did.
Yeah. How long would it take a silo to fill? Or would you not fill
with a car? I can, because this all depends the size of the silo. Like I said, it was round, stars, and triangle. Triangle is the smaller one. Stars hold about, triangle hold maybe a car and a half, which is about 90 ton to 100 ton or 120. Mm-hmm. It all depends. A star bin will hold 3.5 cars, so that's about 350 ton to 400 ton. And a big silo, it's 900 ton in Thunder Bay. Over here in Quebec, they could go to 1,500. Mm. So one car will take about 7 minutes to go up, 10 minutes at the top.
Okay.
So, but for the whole silo, well, 10 minutes per car, 9 cars. Mm. So an hour and a half to 2 hours to fill it up.
So that was one of the jobs you did?
Some of the jobs. Gallery and there's other job like gallery man, which is only that's a job for the shipping. Tunnel man, which I did that job. That's you in the basement of the elevator. When they say that because we didn't have an elevator, which at A House it was automated, it was manpower work. So somebody had to be in the basement in order to open those silo to get shipped out. So every you come in the morning, let's say, and there's a laker waiting to get filled. The inspector in charge will give you a sheet of silo with the grade that's going on board. And he'll say, take the 220, let's say, and the 302 and mix them together. So open half of this side, half of this side, and let the grain go. So tunnel man is basically the big helper of an inspector. If the inspector say, go in the basement and open two notch of this silo. Well, two notch doesn't mean half. You don't open like wide. You're going to make...
The mix.
No, it's not going to be... It's going to be a mix in the grain, but it's not the grain. It's not going to be the grade demanded to go on board. So you'll have déchargement. You'll have to unload the boat, which over the years it did occur a few times that we had some mix going onto the boat, or not the grain that they asked, or heated, a lot of heated. That's the worst thing you could have in the grain, is heated grain. But if your tunnel man does what the inspector says, so usually they're good buddies, those two. They're buddies, they're good friends in life.
And this inspector is the inspector with the company as opposed to the CGC inspector.
That's right. That's an inspector of the company, and he'll deal with his fellow worker of the company as well in the tunnels. And like I said, usually they're pretty good buddies, because the inspector is as good as this guy in the basement. If the guy in the basement don't like the inspector, he could do some nasty things just to put him in trouble, to put the inspector in trouble.
That ever happened?
Sure it did. Hmm. Sure it did. Everything happened. You learn quickly how to get back at somebody. If I wasn't, I never did anything like that, but it wasn't in my mentality to do nasty things just to get back. I'm not a revengeful person, but there is.
So that's one way of getting back at people.
Sure, you opened the wrong bin.
And what's another way? What are other ways that are heard of that are possible?
You just leave your site and you say you got to go to the washroom, and you don't come back for half an hour. Yeah, like, or I don't know, like.
So good relationships were critical, like any workplace.
Yes, or if you work on a cleaner man, that was my posting at the end, a cleaner man operator. That's where you clean the grain. You just don't adjust your machine properly, so you have to clean it twice instead of once. There's like little things that will cost the company extra money, or electricity to use their machinery. It's just little things like this, but the big thing is the tunnel man, because the tunnel man, he's the one that opens the side door at the bottom when there's a boat. He's the one that could control things in a sense. If the inspector doesn't get along with his tunnel man, well, he could just do a mistake and just say it was a pure mistake. I didn't mean on purpose. Prove it. You know, like the inspector cannot prove it. So they try to keep a good relationship with the tunnel man.
So when the wrong or not quite right mix gets into the ship's hold, how do they get it out?
We didn't have the facility like they have here in Quebec with a self-unloader, like, or booms that suck out the grain of the ship. So they called a company called Clara in Thunder Bay to come in with a big vacuum with an air system.
Is that Clara as in C-L-A-R-A?
Yes. Okay. With a big vacuum, and they put got so much pressure, they just put a hose onto the boat and the hole of the boat, and you just or we use our vacuum that we had at the elevator if there wasn't too much to take out. Mm-hmm. Under, let's say, 40 ton, we could do it ourselves. Anything over 50 was unless the boat's paying, or unless whoever's paying, because 50 ton with the little vacuum cleaner we had, it was too long. Yeah. But with Clara's vacuum cleaner, it takes long too, but it was possible. Couple hundred ton or something. Anything above that, you have to ship it out somewhere else, basically. And they would have to use their big equipment. Thunder Bay wasn't really equipped for self-unloading. We're more equipped to load the ship. Down in the coast, like Vancouver and Quebec, that's where they receive the Lakers, so they have to have a facility to unload the Lakers. But Thunder Bay's purpose was to load Lakers, not to unload them. So we weren't really prepared for it.
All right, continuing on then, as you moved along your career, you became more and more knowledgeable of various jobs. So, continue.
So, to get back to the end, basically, of my story of the Thunder Bay, in 2007, we got offered a buyout by, our company, we were public. So we won the stock market.
Okay, just back up there a bit. So UGG So you were there during the time that there was rapid change in ownership and so on. So tell me a little bit about
leading up
to 2007.
I started up as United Grain Growers. We had two elevators. In the mid-90s, we bought a company called Alberta Wheat Pool, mm-hmm. or Manitoba Wheat Pool. Well, no, Alberta Wheat Pool got bought out by Manitoba Wheat Pool, if I'm not mistaken. And then we bought Manitoba Wheat Pool. And then we had three elevators. We kept those three elevators right until SAS Wheat Pool bought us out. So yes, there was a lot of companies being swallowed up by bigger ones, or in our case, we were kind of the biggest one at the end, but we got swallowed up by SAS Wheat Pool. They had more backup, I guess, financially. So the history of the elevators that I work for is I started as United Grain Growers employee. After that, we changed name. After we bought Manitoba Pool, we became Agricor United. And then in 2007, it was a bid between Richardson and JRI. And SAS Wheat Pool to buy us. Well, we all know now that the one that succeeded was SAS Wheat Pool. And then they merged the company and they changed the name to Viterra. But the sad part about it is I was the bottom guy there on the seniority list for many years. I had 30 years, I had 25 and a half years of seniority at our company. And when we got bought out, the way
seniority level?
When you have a new contract, they give you a book.
Yes, the agreement.
Well,
the union agreement?
Well, yeah, the union agreement or the convention.
Oh, okay.
The convention?
Convention. Mm-hmm.
The convention agreement for the union, it says that if we work outside our plant like SAS Pool bought us out, if I go work in their house, I go below their employees. Regardless if he has 1 year seniority or 30 or 35, I go below them. But if they come into our house, it's the opposite. They go below us. So by buying us out, we had three elevators. At the beginning, they wiped two of them. So they kept A house and they closed down McCabe's and they closed down Pool 1. There was only our elevator at A house left. But last December, they closed A house too. So now all my fellow workers, they all work. So they strike. We had about 8 contracts over the time that I was there, and then the time they started working, and the time they lost their employment. We had many contracts we fought for, many strikes, and at the end, they lost their employment over people that had 3 years of seniority or less. Mm-hmm. But the way the agreement was written, it's the way it was written. So they go by it, and that's it. They all work. So. For me, I got lucky in 2007 because the CGC, the last 2 years of my career at the elevator in Thunder Bay, I got the opportunity to go to school in the winter time while I was laid off to become a grain inspector for the company. And thank God, there's a man named Bill Belanger who gave me my opportunity to move ahead because I was the bottom guy in the seniority list. He put a sign up. Anybody who wants to learn to be a grain inspector, put your name down. There was only two put their name down, two or three, and I was one of those guys. And, well, I guess I did really well, so they took me for 2 years in the summertime. I did rail cars, inspect rail cars, and John Harris, which is another good guy, John Harris, to talk to if you want to. He's very, very knowledgeable. He's the only guy I knew that was inspecting grain over there for this company with...
Which company was that?
Agricor United.
Okay.
He gave me a good push, and he says I was doing good work. So they kept me there for the following year, and I met some CGC employees at the time that were inspecting, and they were kind of amazed, or just they appreciated the work that I did. So they gave me a hint that this place is going down and you're bilingual, so go apply for the Canadian Grain Commission down east, which I did. So during the buyout situation, I had vacation at the time scheduled, so I came down to Quebec and I had a meeting with this Canadian Grain Commission. They gave me the job right on the spot, and they told me when I could start. I says, in a week. So I went back home, I packed up, because I was a non-driver, so I told my daughter if she wants to drive me to Quebec with a U-Haul. She said yes. So the following day I arrived in Thunder Bay, I went and signed my paper, which I quit the elevator, and because I had 25 years seniority, I was entitled to a pension, but even with 30% off, it was, you know, $1,800 a month, which is pretty good still. So I signed my papers, I quit the elevators, I packed up my suit, my U-Haul, and I came in Quebec within a week, and I had been working in Quebec for the CGC since.
So that was 2007 that you made the switch?
Yes, and if I would have stayed over there, I would have had 22 weeks work the first year, 9 the second years, and then out the following year. So my choice was the right one.
Yeah. So making the shift then from the company side to the government inspection side, what are your...
It's different, very, very different.
How would you describe the differences? What sticks in your mind?
Even the Grain Commission from Thunder Bay and the Grain Commission from down east is totally different. Thunder Bay, their elevator are all clustered together. Quebec, they everywhere. They have manpower in most of the elevators here, except for Trois-Rivières and Sorel, which when they have a boat, then they dispatch people.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about... let's split this out into two things. The first will be what you noticed as the difference between working in a company situation versus a government situation, and then secondly, working in sort of the connection to the Western system versus the Eastern system. So let's start with the switch from company to government.
Okay. I thought. At the beginning, that was going to be easy working for the CGC. I thought the government was a good choice and a sure bet for the rest of my career, and easy to understand. But I think the private side is easier now. I think the private side gives you, you have a union, they go by the contract, they go by this, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's, you go in, at 8 o'clock, you go there in the morning, and you know your job. You know what you're going to be doing. On the other side, working for the CGC, you don't know what kind of grain you're going to ship out. You don't know when you're going to work. You don't know when the elevator. You see, when you work for an elevator, you're there for your employer, which is the company. Because you're just the little guy, you work for a company, you don't have to dispatch employees. You don't have to, you're going to be always working at the same place, same job, or except for overtime where you need at different places.
Pretty predictable.
Yes, pretty predictable. But the CGC is not predictable. It's tough even. There's many, many aspects that comes in consideration. You know, you could have problems with an increment. You could have problem with... between among ourselves, you could have problem. It's more, I don't know how to explain it really. It's just harder to do, that's all. It's just harder to get along, harder to do, harder to understand the system. And there's a few of us, so you don't have room for too many, you don't have room to get sick, basically. You got to be here. You got to be... I don't know if you understand a little bit what I'm trying to say.
There's... I shouldn't say no fat, because that's not it. There's... if I'm interpreting what you're saying properly, it's... The people to deliver the service is pretty thin. And so everybody has to pull their weight equally. If you don't, there's nobody to... Yes. Falling behind.
See, look, in an elevator, everybody knows basically every job. So if somebody doesn't come in, they take a labor guy and they put him on. But in the Canadian Grand Commission, we need to be here because we designated a job. See, for me right now, I'm a weir. I do rail cars and I do boats, but I could work on the inspection side. If I'm not here, there's nobody that do the weir side here. Like in Quebec, we have a few people, but I don't know. And we're not clustered. The elevator are not clustered together in the East Coast. In West Coast, a little more than here, but they're not clustered as well either. So when they need replacement, they have to take them from a different port and bring them here. So it becomes down east pretty costly. And a lot of times, it gives us extra pressure. We have to go to work because they need me. Excuse me, ma'am, but I have an appointment at 11 o'clock. I have to leave at 1:45. Can you tell me that?
Oh, geez, are we there already? Okay, so let's...
I don't know the time. I'm
yes,
just asking
it's 10...
10:02?
No, it's 25:02.
Well, another...
another 5 minutes. So let's...
Patrick just came here about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was that we've taken
flies,
so long.
Huh?
Oh, doesn't it? Okay, that's fine because actually we've done a lot... We've done a lot of talking about changes, and that was a major section that I was going to deal with anyway. So
I don't really want to talk about my point of view because I'm having a lot of friction here with. I don't like the way it's done, Donnie.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Okay, let's talk about, and it's not even so much whether you like it or
Patrick,
don't like it, but
Patrick
it's
will
different.
Tell you more.
Yeah.
More
so thing. What did you learn? You know, I talked about when you went to work in Thunder Bay initially. You know. What was against your expectations? And you said, well, I was surprised by this, that, and the other thing. So when you came and worked down east then, what was different about the way things worked here that you just weren't aware of when you were working in Thunder Bay?
Well, first of all, the main difference between East Coast and West Coast is the grade of the grain. You have Canadian Western Red Spring, but you have Eastern grain as well. The Eastern grain is not into the... It's the Eastern grain, you could have two wheat, basically, that are ones, one red, which is the best quality of making bread, one red. But because one comes from the East Coast, the other one from the West Coast, you can't put them together on a ship, unless the buyer don't care. Mm-hmm. But usually, and they're not graded totally the same either. They both have the restriction on the grade that you could put, like fusarium and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so what East Coast has as their grain is corn, soya, wheat. And that's about the three major grain that they grow. Mm-hmm. And the red winter. Those are the four grain that they grow a lot on East that will... grade individual, like not like the west, the west side, but Patrick could tell you more about that because that's his department. And that's one reason that I thought it was different, like the grading system. Plus, like I mentioned a little bit, we're not clustered together. So again, the lab in Thunder Bay for the CGC was there for everybody to use, and because all elevators were clustered, there was a nice lab, big, so people could learn. You know, there was a lot of stuff to learn in there. You know, like not just there was a lot of samples to look at. To be good at inspecting grains, you have to look at grain a lot and different kind of harvest. Every harvest are different. One could be the sprouted, the thing that we're wrong with. Another one could be the midge, which is infected by insect eating the grain. Another one could be the yeeted. Another one could be wild oats. And there's many, fusarium, IFAs, whatever. There's a lot of things that could go wrong in the grain. So the more you see it and the more you see different grain, well, then you get better at it. Mm-hmm. When I came in Quebec, there was rail cars to be graded. But now we don't do rail cars. They say that we're not enough inspectors and it costs a lot of money to get them over here, so the government has decided to drop that and they hire a private company now to inspect the grain for the rail cars. Or they previously inspected out west before they get here. So an official grader from out west graded them before he got here. Mm-hmm. So all they have to do is place them in silos as soon as they receive the grain here.
Mm-hmm. Now what elevators then are considered part of the Eastern system?
The Eastern system, you have the main office of Ontario is Chatham. Chatham, okay. That's part of us now. Before it used to be part of Thunder Bay, but now Chatham is part of Quebec. Okay. Other elevators that has employee full-time, you have Quebec, Baie-Comeau, Parc-Cartier, Montréal, Chatham, that I said, but that's about it. But elevators that we'll take care of, that we don't have any manpower full-time, there's Halifax, Sorel, Trois-Rivières, Prescott, Hamilton, Goodrich, and I might forget one, a little one out in Ontario.
So those ones that you mentioned, the second group, do they use private inspection or you go as required?
We go as we get called in to go there. But again, you have to be flexible. This is a job like you have to be on the road, work overtime. Another thing that I thought it was totally different, Thunder Bay has a rule in the union that 5 hours overtime during the week, that's all we could do. There was 5 hours overtime. You couldn't go to midnight. It was 9 o'clock. From 4 till 9 at the end, that was 5 hours overtime, and that's it. Go home after. Go take care of your kids, your family, whatever you did. 13 hours today, that's enough. We could do that twice during the week. During the weekend, we could do 16-hour shifts. Over here, there's 16-hour shift as many as you want. For the employees of the elevator, for the government, we cannot do more than two in a row. But that part of overtime, I find that's the toughest thing.
All that overtime?
Oh, yeah. 16-hour shift is inhuman. When we go to Trois-Rivières, we do 16-hour shift inside. We don't even get out of the elevator.
Yeah.
Not even for lunch. So
we have just a couple of minutes left, and I just want to ask you about the different elevators. Is one elevator pretty much like the next, or do elevators have reputations?
I think they have reputation. I think your reputation could change either you could have a reputation on the cleanliness of the elevator. You could have reputation of the integrity of the elevator if they like to try to put some grain that they're not supposed to without telling you. Okay. Or some will be honest and they'll say, hey, listen, we got some grain. We're going to try to open very little. Mm-hmm. We entitled. And the worst is, or all they have to do is you come to the inspection side and say, hey, we're going to try to get rid of some of our bad grain. We're going to open it a little bit. If you see that we're over, just tell us.
Mm-hmm.
If people were that easy to get along, you know, like that. But instead they try to do it behind you just to see if you're going to see it or not. Well, in terms of integrity, without naming any elevator, yes, the integrity or the reputation of an elevator in the cleanliness of the elevator, like the one I'm here, that I will say, Bunge is a clean elevator.
Who owns Bunge? Like where's Bunge, their head office?
Bunge, United States. Well, Bunge is one of the biggest in the world, right beside Cargill. They got Bunge China, Bunge England, Bunge USA, Bunge Canada. You got Bunge everywhere.
So you have Bunge, Cargill. Who else are owners of those elevators that you work in here?
Oh, Dreyfus, Upper Lakes, Viterra, now that about Montreal. Cargill, Dreyfus, Parc-Cartier, Baie-Comeau. Quebec is Bunge. Montreal is Viterra. Sorel is JRI. Trois-Rivières is Upper Lakes. And out in Ontario, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I can't give you any Chatham. I don't know who belongs, what they belong to in the other places.
I know that I've taken you right up to the time that you have to leave. This has been a fantastic interview. Thank you so much. I do want to get some of those names that you mentioned, so perhaps you could just write them down for me.
Okay.
Of people in Thunder Bay that you've worked with that you think would be good. Like I have Mr. Belanger and Mr.
Mike
Harris.
Toskovich, you could write.
Toskovich spelt?
T-O-S. K-O-V-I-C-H, Toskovich.
Okay.
Toskovich, mm-hmm. Something like
should
that.
Should be easy one to find.
Yeah, Mike Toskovich. Well, Mike. Bill Belanger. You got Billy Green as well.
We've interviewed Mr. Green. Great guy.
Yeah, he's got that little voice, huh? Stefan. Well, he was actually a good man. I mean, I like Murdoch McKay, which is a Green Commissioner.
Yes, Murdoch and I have had several conversations.
He's a good man, too. Yeah. I like him.
Actually, I was reading some history, and there was a Murdoch McKay back in 1919 or 1916 working.
That was his grandpa.
That was his grandpa, yeah.
But, you know, this guy, Murdoch McKay, we had a golf tournament every year, and he spent the money with his money, not the company money.
Yeah.
But he's my boss now. He's funny. He was my boss in Thunder Bay, but now he's my big.
Your big boss.
I mean, I don't see him every day coming to work, but he's my. Yeah. But those are, Billy Green is, Bill Belanger. He was under Billy Green. He was a foreman.
Okay.
But he was a man that he could have suspended me many times for insubordination, I guess, for talking back. But his daughters are born. I got two daughters. He's got two daughters. 3 years apart, both. Same month, both. A week apart, both. So I says, hey, I think I like him. So anyhow, they went to school together, my daughters and his. He's got one daughter, one son, Adam. That's right. I got two daughters.
Okay.
But anyhow, those are the people.
Can I take one more minute? Can I take one more minute?
My phone number at home. If you have any more questions, I could answer
Okay,
yours.
Great. What we hope to do, as I mentioned to you, I think, off tape, was we're hoping that we can get a center established in Thunder Bay to recognize the important work that the grain industry has done, sort of from the shipping to the handling to the shipping out. And if we were to do that, what are important things that you think should be recognized in a center such as that?
Well, I think living in Thunder Bay for 25 years, I know I'm not born there. I'm not an English person. I'm French from Quebec. But for what I understand of Thunder Bay is the industry of the grain was a big factor why the city is still there. Or it got built at the first place, that in lumber. But there was 15 grain elevators when I got in Thunder Bay in 1981. There's maybe 7 standing right now. Operating, maybe 5. So I would say the importance of the people that started the industry, you know, the importance. I think we were the hub, the central hub of the grain exportation of a good part of the economy of Canada back in for a good part of our the last the 19th 20th century now in 21st. So during the 20th century, many people sweat a lot to build those things and try to make the city a good city. And we all know now that Thunder Bay is changing a way to go, and they're more medical oriented now and more technological. But back then it was hard labor. You know, Thunder Bay was a hard labor city. It was people that, good men, that wanted to work, you know, get up in the morning, go to do their time at work and come home, and they weren't maybe educated like the way people are now, but they were good people. I mean, a lot of immigrants as well that worked there, you know, Italians, Finlanders, Ukrainians, whatever, Polish, French, English. So to build this elevator and to bring an history, I guess, of what Thunder Bay stands for.
Yeah.
I miss Thunder Bay. I miss Thunder Bay.
Okay, thank you.
So besides that, I don't
so
know.
Much.
I just said what I think of Thunder Bay and what I think the industry. Without the elevators, Thunder Bay wouldn't be the way it is. That's my point of view. I think Thunder Bay was built because of the end of the Great Lakes. That was the further you could go inland, and lumber and grain was dispatched there and then shipped out from there. But without the grain, I don't know if they would have survived. Well, I have 100,000 people there. The grain brought business. Can't forget the people that worked, and you know, that's basically it.